Hey, what's going on? It's Bill Burr. It's time for the Thursday afternoon, just before Friday, Monday morning podcast. And I'm just checking in on you. Checking in to see how your week's going. Before I get started, this is going to be a special podcast, so I have a couple of special announcements. Steven Adler is back together with Adler's Appetite, and they're going to be playing at the Rose in Pasadena on August 23rd, and then he's going to be in Vegas at the Golden Nugget on the 24th and on the 25th. This is August, all August dates, at the Canyon Club in Santa Clarita. If you want to see one of the best drummers I've ever seen in my life, check out Adler's Appetite. We'll have a link and all that type of stuff. Go out and go check out.
Oh, Jesus, I forgot to promote a couple of things. All right. Number one, I'm going to be at Madison Square Garden November 7th for the New York Comedy Festival. Tickets are on sale now. I believe that's a Wednesday. Hump day, everybody. I didn't read the one read I had. Hubble, everybody. Do you have eyes? Do they not work as well as they should? Do you like spending less money on things more money on things? Do you know what the internet is? If you answered yes to any or all these questions, then visit HubbleContacts.com. Motivate your audience. Choose one or two. All right, I guess these are positive things. Talk about how you've been wearing Hubble contacts for the past 25 years. I haven't. Before, I didn't see things, and now I see. I didn't wear those fucking things. I don't have contacts. I have no idea. I don't know what they're saying. These guys make contact lenses, and they're fucking great. How is that? With Humble, you'll get a fresh pair of lenses for every single day for less than 60, for less, 60 contacts for $33. Do the math. That's barely a dollar a day. This is way more affordable than other brands. Go to HubbleContacts.com and get your first 2 weeks for free. Hubble sells directly to you, so they can offer contacts at a more affordable price. They can send you to an optometrist if you don't have a prescription. Featured in Vogue, GQ, TechCrunch, Mashable, and now the Monday morning podcast, or Thursday afternoon just before Friday. So do what I evidently did. 100%, and go to HubbleContacts.com and get your first 2 weeks of lenses for free. That's HubbleContacts.com.
And with that, the other announcement I have to make, I have a very special guest, a long time waiting, long time in the coming for whatever fucking reason. We've hung out a million times. We never thought to do a podcast. I didn't want to infringe on the man's talents. Please welcome Mr. Tom Rhodes.
Yay.
Yay for me. What's up, brother?
How are you, brother?
I'm doing good, man. I'm so psyched you're on the podcast. You're one of the best comics I've known. I've known you for like 20, I don't know how many years.
25 years, I think. Long
way
time.
Back in L.A. And
I met you when I was living in New York, like 98, 99.
Was that it?
Yeah.
Maybe that was what it was. I thought I met you in like 95 or 96 out here in L.A. Mm. I was out here briefly. You probably walked by with your romantic novel hair that you had back then. Romance novel haircut. And me with my red afro. Two hacks passing in the night, right? Trying to get better. And then I think the first time I like officially kind of met you and was hanging out.
Back when we both had folic strength.
Yes. And I was very excited that you knew who I was. Because I had seen you at Eating It. Of all places, which is where I became a huge fan of your stand-up. I've told you this story before, but I'm going to tell the listeners, where you were talking about some sort of extracurricular activity that you were doing.
I had done mushrooms in Amsterdam in Vondel Park.
Yes. And I just remember you describing the whole fucking trip of it. And I just remember you were just, at one point, you were just like, I was running through the grass on my tippy toes. And it's just, something about that was like, you know, there's nothing with alcohol. There's nothing worse than just seeing somebody who's like completely fucked up. But like with mushrooms, there's like a oneness with the world where you literally watch an adult become a child or something. I just thought you described it. I've never taken mushrooms, but like from what I've seen, when I've seen people tripping it. And I remember I was there with Nia way back in the day when we were still boyfriend, girlfriend, and we were dying laughing. And that became like, you know, like one of the a catchphrase for us. You know, we would just be walking around the apartment, and one would be in the other room, and we'd just yell that out.
Running through the grass on my tippy toes.
We both would just start laughing.
That's the greatest compliment you could get, when like a joke or a sentence from a joke becomes part of somebody's vernacular, you know?
Oh, yeah. There's been a few. There's the Dave Chappelle. Dave Chappelle had a bit about how, you know, he likes eating chicken, and he's a black dude, so there's that weird sort of stereotype. He's like, but I like it. He goes, but I won't eat it in public. Because yeah. He goes, I'm afraid there'll be some white people around going, look at him. He loves it. So
just like the encyclopedia says. Wasn't that the last line of that bit?
I don't remember, but I just remember.
That was a classic.
To this day.
I know, I can't eat fried chicken without thinking of that line.
Well, to this day, when me and Nia are hanging out, if we're eating food, and if she go, how's it taste? I go, it's good. I like it. And she just go, look at him. He loves it. Like, there was a few of those.
He loves it.
Yeah. Now I got to go through all of them. Sarah Silverman. Sarah Silverman said something about how she always bought condoms or something. I forget. All I just remember was the punchline was, because I do a lot of fucking. And I remember Neil was watching that. We're in this little one-bedroom apartment, as everything is in New York, little. And I was shaving in the other room, and I just heard I didn't really even hear the setup, which is probably why I can't remember it, but I just bursted out laughing while I was shaving. So anyway, you're part of my Mount Rushmore of lines that just never, it just never left my head. I don't know why. So, and furthermore, I would say either you or Doug Stanhope have probably put the most, like, stand-up miles on the odometer as far as the places that you've played, how far you've gone. But, I mean, you might have to be the king, man. You were telling me that at some point in this podcast you were going to start rattling off your dates. If actually you sat down here looking like you didn't have a care in the world and you just casually mentioned to me that you're off to Mongolia tomorrow.
Tomorrow, yeah.
Yeah, I would be a fucking wreck going like, am I going to forget something? I would have to check 50 times to make sure I have my passport, and I would stick it in the bag, and I would zip it shut, and then look to make sure, and I would zip it shut again, and then I would still have to check it before I left the house, in the car, on the way to the airport, before I started talking that anxiety down. Because
all I need is my Genghis Khan biography to reread on the plane, that's it.
Is that how you say it? It's not Genghis?
Yeah, I played in Mongolia last October. And it was freezing. It was in the 30s.
So this is you're the only guy I know. Not only has been to Mongolia, but now it's his return engagement. Return to Mongolia.
Well, you know, it was really awesome. The comedians there, wonderful guys. I mean, and Mongolians are beautiful. I mean, they look like the people in Avatar, but without the blue. And five of the local Mongolian comedians met me at the airport when I arrived. And they cheered.
Wow.
They cheered when I came out. I'm like the most famous comedian that's ever played in Mongolia. So they like bent over backwards showing me Ulaanbaatar, and we drove out to the world's largest Genghis Khan statue. And yeah, they taught me that it's Genghis Khan, not Genghis. Khan. And those white...
I like how you're not obnoxious with that information. You could be really cunty at a party. excuse me, guys. I don't want to interrupt. It's Genghis Khan?
Yeah, and Americans and other people say, though, they call those white round tents yurts, but they actually call them gurs in Mongolia. So
I don't know anything about it other than it's just sort of spoons with northern China. It's between them and Russia.
It's between China and Russia. And
it's a hell of a place.
So I liked it so much, and I wanted to go back in summer and see it when it wasn't bone-chilling cold. So it's kind of a vacation. So, I mean, I'm going to do a gig there, but I'm going to go in. I'm going to spend like 4 days there. Mm-hmm. These guys are going to take me way out into the country. We're going to sleep in a gur, one of those round tents.
Dude, what the?
Shoot some arrows. Do some Mongolian warrior activities, and then I got a gig.
Dude, you got to tell Rogan about this. Rogan sounds like he would be all over this.
Oh, I'm sure he would love it. I'm sure you would love it. It's, you know, that's the...
I've shot some arrows in my time. I went bow fishing in some bayou down in fucking, I don't know where the hell it was, somewhere outside of New Orleans.
It's a great thing about being a comedian. I remember I was in Alaska years ago. I did a gig in Ketchikan, and I met the perfect Alaskan guy who took me fishing on his charter boat and then took me skeet shooting.
I always feel like when you meet those guys, there's always some sort of like raggedy plane you get in first that lands on water, or they put snowshoes on the bottom of it.
Planes.
A pontoon. You're the only guy I know that's played Vietnam.
Oh, I love Vietnam. You know, my
father. You're the only guy I know that watches like Ken Burns documentaries. Like, yeah, I've been there.
Yeah.
I've played there.
Yeah. I know what it looks like now.
I've done all of that.
I did that special for Comedy Central in 1995 called Viva Vietnam. I got to go to Vietnam.
You've been going there for over 20 years?
I was the first comedian ever to have a development deal with Comedy Central. And so I could do whatever I wanted. It was like being a junior filmmaker almost. So
in 1994,
Bill Clinton lifted the travel ban on Vietnam the way like Obama lifted the travel ban on Cuba. Mm-hmm. And my father fought in Vietnam. He flew helicopters. He was shot down. Everyone in his helicopter.
Can you tell that story?
Yeah.
Real quickly?
Yeah. So, and this is why Vietnam has always been really important. It's been a big thing in our family. So my father flew helicopters in Vietnam in 1969. He was stationed in Pleiku. And there was all these soldiers stuck on the ground. They're surrounded by the North Vietnamese soldiers, and they're just getting slaughtered. So my father had to fly in and rescue these guys.
How old was he?
He actually joined. My dad was one of those knuckleheads. Mm-hmm. So he was 30. His buddies in his unit called him Methuselah because he was like the oldest guy there because everybody else was 19. You know, he just thought, you know, he grew up on John Wayne movies.
Hilarious.
He thought that, you know, he was one of those guys that thought
gung-ho.
When your country needed you, you know? So I got the letter from the army and all his medals after he died. So he made three attempts to land to save these guys. And it took so much heavy fire, he had to lift up, circle around, and on the fourth attempt, he gets down. And there's like 20 guys down there still alive. And it's life or death. So they all like jump on the helicopter. And
He's
pulling up, you know, and he's just getting rattled with so much machine gun fire, that the helicopter nosedived down, and everybody died in the helicopter except for him and his co-pilot, who was knocked unconscious. He unhooks him, drags him across the field under heavy fire, and then they had to wait there for like an hour or two before someone could come in and rescue
them.
And
was he shooting back at them, or what?
Well, it's funny, my dad would laugh when he tells the story, because he always had this pistol that he would take with him when he was flying, and then the one day he forgot it, he gets shot down. So he wasn't shooting back.
Fuck.
He didn't have a gun. So my dad was a decorated war hero, and he got like five medals.
I've been over your house. Tom has it framed. He has the letter, and there's like, you know,
the letter from the army saying what he did, from his commanding officer.
And there's almost not enough room in the frame for all of the medals. It's like five.
There's like six medals, five were from that one incident. He got the Distinguished Flying Cross, and my father is buried in Arlington National Cemetery,
as he should be.
When you got to be a badass to get in there, you know.
I would say he qualifies.
So my dad...
I'll probably be buried across the street and like in front of a 7-Eleven.
I want a Viking funeral pyre. So my dad, every year, he would have a reunion with his Vietnam veteran helicopter buddies. Mm-hmm. It was like big thing for him. And my dad also loved stand-up comedy. My dad loved Pryor, and my dad's the reason I'm a comedian. You know, he had all... Mm-hmm. I remember driving around as a little kid listening to Richard Pryor with my dad.
So was he thrilled that you became a comedian?
Oh, yeah. My dad drove me to my first open mic night. Stand-up comedy was always revered in my family. And, well, especially, you know, because of my dad. And my dad worshipped Pryor. He had Bob Newhart records and...
Jeez, great taste, too.
Yeah. So I think those were like my two biggest influences as a kid. And then my family's from Washington, D.C., and my uncle did open mic nights for 1 year in 1978. I'm 11 years old. My dad took me to see my uncle perform at this open mic night. And it was a club called El Brookman's in D.C. And the entrance was next to the stage. Mm-hmm. The show's in progress. We walk in. I'm wearing a Washington Redskins jacket. The comedian on stage pulls me on stage. And he starts interviewing me like I'm the coach of the Redskins. And I'm like, I'm 11. I'm some bashful, dopey kid. I give, you know.
It's a great bit, though.
One-word answers. Yes. No.
Right.
But I'll never forget standing on that stage and seeing all those happy people with their heads thrown back in laughter and all the teeth in their mouth. And that moment changed my life. And I, you know, and I can still picture it. You know, it's, black people, Latin people, white people, like Asian people, just the flavors of humanity.
Right.
And I just thought that that was the most magical place in the world, to stand on stage making people laugh. So I became a student of comedy after that and would keep notebooks. And then I started when I was 17 with a fake ID.
Yeah, you still have all your comedy. Like your apartment, first of all, it's cool as shit. It's also like this... it's the Smithsonian of your life. And he has his dad's helmet.
From Vietnam, he was shot down.
The one that he was wearing. I got chills looking at that thing.
Yeah.
Like, that's like...
imagine like, what was going through his brain when he was wearing that helmet.
Yes, and you had told me the story as we were sitting there smoking a wonderful cigar. And you told me the story, and then and you were like, I still have the helmet in there. I was like, oh, wow, man. I couldn't believe it. And then to walk in and see it, and just the heaviness of it. Once there's like a story attached to it, like if you just got a helmet and it was like, yeah, this is like, some memorabilia thing. This is, and you have to wonder what happened, to actually know what happened while that thing was. I mean, I'm into that type of shit. Like, I got that weird thing of like, if I know the story behind it, which is why I have to be careful, because I'll just fill my house up with a bunch of shit like that. And then I have all this fucking anxiety that I have no place to set anything down. You know, I kind of have this thing, cause I kind of grew up with semi hoarders that just would not fucking throw anything out, you know, 40 years of magazines and shit.
A cool thing about, you know, I had everything in storage for 10 years. I just traveled the world. I decided not to live anywhere.
Do you think
so I got to preserve all these great things, you know?
But like, do you think your dad being in Vietnam and then you learning about that, is that how you got the travel bug to the level you did? You're on like some Tom Brokaw level shit here.
Maybe. And my mother's from Argentina. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, I had performed everywhere in the United States, you know, 20, 30 times, and I wanted to branch out. But back to Vietnam, I mean, that was a really special thing for me to go there, and I filmed this hour special called Viva Vietnam for Comedy Central. It was like a travel log type of thing. Did the Jane Fonda workout tape in Hanoi with some old women in a park. Went to Da Nang, China Beach, set up a slip and slide.
Fill in the young people about why Jane Fonda is funny for that.
Vietnam veterans hate Jane Fonda's guts. Still to this day, veterans... at those Vietnam reunions my dad would go to, they still sell the Jane Fonda urine... the thing for like a urinal guard with her picture on it. You know what I'm... You ever
oh,
seen
like
those?
A urinal cake?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, like the little plastic thing holes on it.
Oh, yeah, okay. And they
so
have her
at the
face
height of the Vietnam
that.
War, Jane Fonda goes to Hanoi, the capital of the people we're having a war with. And she's anti-war. And they took pictures of her on, like, anti-aircraft artillery and... And then she met the POWs, and one of them slipped her a note. And then she apparently, if I remember the story correctly, she gave that to the Vietnamese prison guards. And
oh,
guy was tortured extra for slipping her a note.
Oh, God. That has to be the ultimate stupid celebrity moment.
Yeah.
Where you're just so, like, you know, sucking the dick of your own fucking ego that you go and do something like that to just...
Well, I think being against a war is okay.
To go to the
Capitol and...
I've watched enough war movies that my heart would be in my fucking throat. The second you get the note, you're like, do I got to put this under my tongue or put it up my ass? Like, what do I got to do?
Yeah.
I got to do it. I know this is like some top secret shit here.
Yeah. But so in 1990, we filmed
Excuse me, guard. Came at you, bitch.
This man slipped me a note. He'll need extra bamboo under his fingernails. So September 94, we filmed it. And like Americans, it was only like vets that went there. Like it hadn't become like a tourist place yet. So in this park in Hanoi, old women would gather and do Tai Chi in the morning. So at the time in 94, early 90s, Jane Fonda was making these exercise tapes. Mm-hmm. And we set up a television with a VCR and we brought the tape. And 1994 technology, we had to run an extension cord like five blocks to set this up in the park. And these old women loved it. They took to it and they started doing it. And she goes, now turn to the right. And I'll say, I'll say she turned to the right.
Did you see, can you imagine her fucking agent when she was telling him that I'm going to go to North Vietnam? He's just sitting there, Jane, I've worked so hard with you to get you to this level. I'm imploring you not to do this. Oh, Murray. It's like a bad Mary Tyler Moore episode. God, what a fuck. She's sort of like the first Dennis Rodman. Like when, by the time Dennis did it, it was just been so much. Like, first of all, they didn't have our guys, you know, in POW
being tortured,
camps.
Yeah.
And
what was that guy's name? Otto Warmbier. It was the guy that
I have no clue who that is. Did he play for the Bengals?
I'm the only one who remembers this guy's name. I think he was from Chicago. He was there. He went to North Korea on vacation a few years ago, and he stole a banner out of a basement of a hotel.
Kid. Yeah,
and they sent him. They sentenced him to, you know, hard labor for life, and then
they gave him back
a year later.
A coma,
they
yeah.
sent him back as a vegetable.
Yeah, he was in a coma.
Yeah,
and he died. Yeah,
and he died. A heartbreaking story. So,
yeah, he went up. He went in there. Like, yeah, but he took that post or whatever, which is, you know, something you don't do. I remember somebody on the internet was like, classic example of white privilege.
Oh my god!
It's just like even this, you have to turn into that.
Yeah.
Can't we all just be like, wow, that's somebody's son?
Yeah.
You know, can't you just do that? Do you have to turn it into like a fucking hashtag social justice, whatever fucking moment?
Everyone's being dehumanized.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't know. That was one of those
but
things.
But my mother
where it's just like,
can't
all right,
understand
you know?
Why anybody would go to Vietnam on vacation. They killed so many of our, she knew so many people that died, you
yeah.
know? And I went back in 2014. Hanoi was my favorite. It's French tree-lined boulevards. It's really the lake that John McCain was shot down in, and the whole town
now has swan boats.
now has swan pedal boats.
No, it doesn't.
I told you that.
Did you tell me that?
I did tell you that.
I was just using my Boston background.
Yeah, you can rent. Couples go there and rent swan paddle boats.
See, that's why I don't watch people's stand-up specials.
Because things stick in your head.
Because I forget. Because I was sitting there, like, oh, I'm going
to
throw in the swan joke thing from
Boston. Yeah, we were
Boston
having cigars
comic.
Right when I got back. So I went in 2014, this
Jesus
English guy
Christ.
Who runs the gig there in Hanoi also gives motorcycle tours of the North in Vietnam. So I went back April of this year, and I went on this. It was my dream to go on this motorcycle journey. And we were 45 miles north of Hanoi, going up a mountain, a little winding road, the bike went out from under me, and I wrecked. And
I was going to say, how good a rider are you?
It was the fourth time I've been on a motorcycle, and I've been afraid of motorcycles my whole life. So it was something I wanted to do to break my fear. And thank God I was wearing a helmet. My head bounced off the road, but I was fine, and took a lot of skin off my elbow. But
you didn't think of just taking the safety course out here where you ride around a parking lot?
My wife's brother, my wife is from Holland, and her brother teaches motorcycle lessons in Rotterdam. So last summer when I was in Rotterdam visiting her family, he took me out, and I did that in the parking lot.
Oh, okay.
So I did.
Then how long between that and then just riding up a fucking mountain in Vietnam?
What, 8-10 months later?
Yeah, dude, that's I took my ground school and didn't fly again. And 8 months later, I decided to fly.
I had a wreck on a dirt bike when I was 14.
Hurricane.
And I like tore a tendon in my arm and I missed a baseball season, which was a big deal when you're 14.
Yeah.
And then I didn't, when I lived in Amsterdam and I had the, worked for this Dutch travel show for a year, I got to do a highlight on Peru and we went to the Nazca lines. You know, those lines that people think are alien landing strips. They weren't discovered until the 1920s.
That shit on that cover of that Zeppelin box set? You're talking a really dumb guy here, dude. That's weird. You're like talking English, but half of this shit you're saying, like, I don't know what that is. This is taking me back to high school.
Desert, there's these desert drawings, and they weren't discovered until the 1920s when aircraft was first flying over Peru. And one's a condor, one's a monkey, and then it looks like these landing strips in between it. And
Why would you make it like that if everyone didn't know how to fly back then, right? Is that what they asked?
Well, it's like 1,000 years old. How could they have done it unless aliens helped them?
Maybe, just maybe.
That's the theory.
They developed some sort of hot air balloon before anybody else, and then they all perished in some sort of plague. And they're, you know, everything was biodegradable back then. How are you going to find their hot air balloon? It doesn't always have to be aliens, does it?
Yeah, I used to do a line years ago that the Incas did cocaine. I guess that explains why they were building UFO landing strips in the desert. They were up all night.
Tell me about a couple things I want to ask. One of my favorite podcast episodes ever was the one that you did with the late, great John Fox, who was, I never met him, but I heard all of the stories. He was like...
Road Viking.
I mean, he created the cliches. It was kind of like, I don't know, the Elvis or like, you know, the early days of rock and roll where there was no, you know, go out and go create it and create what the fuck this is going to be. And he kind of did that as far as every fucking cliche now, that guy was. And listening to that podcast with him, because I'd only heard of him, and I never really, you know, there's all these short little clips of him on the internet just to get like an hour and 10 minutes, however long it is, of him telling stories, and then just hearing the stories in his voice, like that, that crazy
that
laugh he had.
Voice,
oh,
yeah.
My God. Oh, my God. Like, amazing. How did you get, like, everybody, my buddy Paul Verzi met him and was like, man, that guy he was a fucking sweetheart. And Verzi met him right towards the end. And he actually, they're working in like Milwaukee or something. And he watched his set and actually gave him a couple of tags, encouraged him and all of that. And I don't know if he was sick yet, but he just was, oh man, he was like the nicest guy and all of that type of stuff. So I'm so glad that you did that episode. But how did you get to meet John?
I worked with him when I was really young. I think I was 19 when I worked with him in Jacksonville, Florida. There used to be a Punchline there. It was a great room. And
I used to do the Comedy Zone down there.
This was way before that. You know, the Atlanta Punchline. In the boom in the late 80s, there was Punchline comedy clubs all over the South. And the one in Jacksonville was one of the best. And the guys that owned it, it was like four guys, and then they all got like Mercedes and BMWs, and then they're raking in so much money, they moved it to a bigger venue. They had like a 150-seat room, then they moved it to a 500-seat room, and the place was never the same, It went out of business. Yeah. But at one time, that was like it was one of the greatest clubs in the South. So I worked with him, and, you know, John Fox was legendary for kind of being a womanizer, coke freak, booze hound, all that.
I think he liked me
because I could drink heavily, and I was relatively cute and
would attract
some ladies. So yeah. He was on one of the first.
Dude, Rodney that right, right. That is next level, like. Getting pussy where it's so, that reminded me of Pedro Martinez when he lost the heat on his fastball. So he developed a couple other pitches and he was able to stay in the league at a high level. So he's sitting there crushing ass. Cause he was a good looking guy when he was young, right? Blonde hair, had the mullet, which was the look, the whole Miami Vice look he could pull out, was crushing ass. And then all of a sudden he starts to, you know, loses a little heat on his fastball. He's like, he's a good looking young fella. I'll bring him along. that'll keep bringing the ladies up to the light here.
That's the thing people don't think of when they think of him. When he was on one of those early Rodney Dangerfield young comedian specials. And he looked like a California surfer guy.
Yeah.
He had blonde hair, but
he's tan. Great shape. The whole thing.
And then he got older and pudgy, and he looked like an older white guy alcoholic dude. So
the life caught up with him.
He helped me get in. He loved me. Mm-hmm. And he helped me get in with Chicago, Zanies, where he was the man. You know, that was his hometown. He was from Waukegan, Illinois, but... he was Mr. Chicago. So he gets me work with him in Chicago, booked like 3 weeks, the downtown room and a couple of the suburban rooms for a couple of weeks. I'm 19. I'd never been to Chicago. And it was sold out every night. And he was the man. Seika, one of his porn star, came. And he took me to the Blues Brothers, had a bar.
Mm-hmm.
Remember doing cocaine after hours off the pinball machine? He took me to a Cubs game.
He took you under his wing.
He took me under his wing. But it was great. I mean,
come here, kid.
You know, I had only been doing comedy for 2 years, and I'm in Chicago playing in sold-out rooms opening for this guy. But he took me to see the Cubs. And he was kind of a Chicago celebrity back then.
Yeah.
And he was buddies with Steve Stone. And he actually took me up. We got to go up into the booth when Harry Carey sang "Take Me Out to the Ball Game."
Jesus Christ.
And like Harry Carey's like, you know, half in the bag, leaning out the window, and they had to hold his belt so he didn't fall out.
I mean, who led a better life than that guy? Gets to announce baseball while he's just catching a buzz, and everybody just thought it was hilarious that he was like, he was literally drunk.
Yeah.
In
the afternoon.
On the air.
So, John Fox was really nice to me, and I knew him through the years. And then trials and tribulations and bad relationships and years of booze and excess. It was kind of sad. He was kind of the cautionary tale of, you know, you don't want to be this road guy who is just chasing women and partying and stuff forever, because it was really a sad end for that guy. And then he lived in the apartment building next door to the apartment where the Zanies puts the comedians in Chicago. It's an old town. And there's the Old Town Ale House, which I remember him taking me there. And all these, that area in the late 80s was great. I'm a kid, and it was, you know, it was so much fun. And then he was kind of like sad, lonely, drunk guy at the Old Town Ale House towards the end.
What was towards the end? Like, when did it start becoming, when did it sort of shift where the industry wasn't...
He stopped getting work, and I...
Was that in the 90s?
I can't remember.
Right.
I can't remember what year I did that recording with him.
I don't think it was the 90s, because when I was...
No, it was after the early 1000s.
Yeah, because when I was in the 90s, when I was starting to get out there on the road, it was... I would hear legendary stories about him, and then everywhere I had just been, it seemed Doug Stanhope was there and had some sort of debauchery in the fucking green room. And I remember the first time I met Doug Stanhope, I instantly loved the guy. But before I met him, I was like, who the fuck is this Stanhope guy? Why the fuck can't he, you know, do all this shit outside of the goddamn the comedy condo? And but I would always hear, like, oh my God, the Atlanta Punchline. They used to have stories. I don't. There's a couple of guys who are still alive, so I don't want to fucking put their shit out there. But there was like a couple of guys on that Mount Rushmore of like the waitstaff would be so excited that they were coming to town, and after like maybe a night and a half, like that Sunday night show seemed like 3 years away. And they were just like, I don't think I'm going to make it. Because there was those guys that came to town and they were like this Pied Piper in the entire fucking wait staff. They had this charisma. All the bartenders, the club owners, he would just take them on a crawl night after night after fucking night. This other guy that I know of, who I'm not going to mention his name, like he had a nickname and all that. And he would pick up the phone and he would say a name like Tom. You're like, yeah. And he'd be like, it's so-and-so. And the running joke was you would just scream in horror knowing that he was coming to town, he was going to stay with you, and that you guys were going to be hitting a bottle or two every... It would be like trying to keep up with Lemmy. Some of these guys, it reminds me of some of like the Lemmy Motorhead stories that you hear of him. So
yeah, but when you don't have the albums and the following to fall back on. Like, I remember the thing, John Fox, when he was still like surfer, good-looking guy, I remember he would walk by the waitress station and he would go... he would just announce, "Fuck me before I'm famous." He would say that out loud to the he never would have survived the Me Too movement.
Oh my God,
But so when he was so towards the end, and you know, and I always had a soft spot in the from my heart for the guy because he helped me when I was a young comedian, and so I did that interview with him, and the thing that I that stands out for me on that interview that I did with him. Oh, so there was one when it got sad for him. I remember there was some turbulent relationship he was in, and he was falling apart. Mm-hmm. And as an alcoholic, and he's in this terrible relationship. And the girl had scratched his face like really bad, and so he had all these scratch marks on his face. And there was a story in Atlanta about him breaking down on stage and crying and. Just some really sad stories and shit that happened to him. But the thing that stands
out... It's a fucking movie.
Yeah. The thing that stands out for me about that interview was that he still believed in love. He's talking about... And he had been through all this shit in his life. And, you know, he's older, pudgy, alcoholic guy past his prime. And he's still like, talking about love. And
it's the, like Raging you know, Bull, but the stand-up version. Like De Niro, back in the day, he could have played John Fox, like the John Fox story. It's the same thing. And in the end, he ends up doing stand-up in Raging Bull.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. Well, you cleaned up your act how long ago?
I've been sober for almost 5 years.
That's fucking amazing. I've been, I finally kind of cleaned up my act. I don't think I would ever not do it again, but like I drank like the last day of June and then I drank August 7th and I'm not going to drink again until like October. Now I sort of drink like the way I smoke cigars, or I should say the way I would like to smoke cigars, which I like, you know, a couple times a month or every other month or something like that. You know, I'm trying, like, you know, I got a kid. I'm a super old fucking dad to have a kid. So it's just like, I have to fucking be around until my kid has it figured out.
Every warrior needs to move on to wise men.
Yeah. Well,
you know, you can't be out pounding it. And one of the greatest things that ever happened to me was giving up the booze. And I mean, and I feasted from the banquet of life. You know, I lived in Amsterdam, you know,
hosted a talk show over there.
London.
You were like the Dave Letterman of
Europe. Yeah, I had a late night talk show for 2 years on Dutch television. But, you know, I went through some pretty hardcore tragedies. My dad, who I adored, was killed by a drunk driver in 2009.
Dude, the irony of that. When you see that helmet, that
surviving Vietnam,
all of that, and the medals and all that, and then just some jackass
in Anaheim,
which, you know, we've all fucking done. So I can't, but like, it's just fucking unbelievable.
And then my little sister, who I was really close with, died of breast cancer in 2011. My wife and I actually got married at her hospital bedside the day before she died of cancer because I didn't want her to miss it. So that was 2011. So 2012, 2013, I had stopped drinking for pleasure. You know what I'm saying? I was just like numbing myself because I was so heartbroken. And then January 1st, 2014, in Philadelphia, I blacked out and busted my head open. And I got like 6 stitches on my forehead. I had a black eye. The next day I looked in the mirror and I saw so much ugliness. And I knew.
Did you know that was the moment when you looked in the mirror?
Yeah, I mean, I had been thinking about it and I just thought vanity was a big reason because I saw so much ugliness in the mirror, but also I knew it was holding me back as a comedian. I knew I could be a better comedian if I stopped drinking every night. And, you know, and I didn't go to any AA meetings, which AA people always get offended when I say that. But I just had enough. And the first couple of weeks, you're a little bumpy, but you know, you can get through it.
I'm just picturing you looking in the mirror with your black eye in the cut and just being like, all right, you win.
Yeah.
You win. I'm not fucking doing this.
Well, what happened was I looked in the mirror and I just thought, I want to go 1 year. When I looked in the mirror, what I said to myself was, I want to go 1 year and see what it's like not being drunk every night, to see what I could get done. And I got so much done, writing jokes and, you know, working on my book and different projects and stuff. That's what made me stick with it.
Yeah. Well, mine, having a kid now too. It's like, is every dad told me, say, oh yeah, have a kid. That'll curb your drinking, because they don't give a shit or have any sort of concept of what being hungover is.
Yeah.
And they wake up with like, they're on a full tank, like their whole body is brand new, nothing hurts, and they're ready to just, it's just like, da 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 da. They get right in your face. Hi! Yelling and shit. And it's just like, it's actually, you know, I'm finding, if I'm going to go out and do stand up, I have to be out the door by 8 o'clock. 8:05, I'm going to fall asleep. It's just one of those things. Like, she gets up at like 6:45 in the morning. And that happened to me last night, where I was like, I'm going to go out. I was going to go see Mission Impossible, because I wanted to watch Tom Cruise, speaking of helicopters, flying that helicopter. And I just, the next showing isn't until 10 or 10:30. And I knew, I was like, I'm going to fall asleep in the middle of Mission Impossible, Tom Cruise action, summer action movie. I am so fucking tired, I'm going to fall asleep. So, plus, I want to take my knee along to go see it in like IMAX, get the whole thing before, the whole experience before it goes away. So, let me see. Let's promote. So, you're going to be in Mongolia. What else do you got? Like, I don't know if I have any listeners there. That was such a great story about how supportive the comics were, because I did a gig in India, and like most of the crowd was comedians. I was so happy that I didn't realize that, because I would have been like intimidated, like, oh God, they're all going to be like, what's the next joke structure? And afterwards, we all hung out, and it was like, it was weird. It was like I was hanging at a comedy club on the other side of the world in like total, their color, but it was the exact same fucking questions. Do you write on stage? Do you do that?
Yeah.
Don't you think this guy's overrated? They would say shit like that. I was like, oh my God, it's the exact same fucking thing.
The guys that were probably over there emulating your gestures and stuff, because they hung out with you.
No, but I actually, what I found was people in India are fucking hilarious. It's kind of that same vibe of like when you go to Ireland and Scotland, when you just meet like
yeah, these people, I mean, like, this is what I love the most about comedy, characters. The you know, the fraternity of it, you know?
Yeah, they're like, people in Australia are funny. They're just fucking funny. I don't know what it is. And then other places you go, I'm not going to mention, because I don't want shit on any. You just go and they're just like, these people are polite. And then you go to these other places, it's just like, you just, it's the second you walk into the airport, you just start seeing characters. You're like, all right, this is going to be a good show. These people are cool. So,
And I'm so glad you went to that storer in Paris, and on your podcast,
oh yeah,
you wouldn't give the name of it.
Oh yeah,
because I turned you onto it.
Well, I didn't want. So I'm just picturing you standing in line.
35 emails. Oh, sorry. People going, what's the name of that patisserie in Paris?
Because I was picturing you going there the next time, standing in this line. You know, you're all excited, like that fucking asshole Bill said it on his podcast. Now I got to stand in.
It's ruined.
But there's already, the word is kind of out. People already know. And when people come up to me, I tell them like what it is. And I actually like the sandwiches better.
The sandwiches are amazing. Remember, yeah, what I told you, what I tell everybody, get one of the sandwiches because they're incredible, and then buy one for later, for when you're walking around Paris and you think to yourself, damn, I wish I'd have bought another sandwich for later. You'll
be so happy. And it doesn't overdo it. It doesn't. Yeah. It just makes you want to keep going back. So, you know, a lot of that Mission Impossible, I heard,
is in Paris.
It's shot in Paris, yeah. I got to check that out. But I keep trying to get to your dates, Taylor.
Okay, I'm sorry. All right.
You're playing the Funny Bone in Mongolia.
No. It's called the UB, Ulaanbaatar is called, they call it UB City. So it's the UB City Comedy Club. Mm-hmm. Okay. So check out the schedule I have for the rest of the year. August 22nd, I'm in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. August 24th, I'm in Beijing, China. August 25th, Shanghai. August 30th through September 2nd, I'm at Levity Live in West Nyack, New York.
Are you driving to these gigs?
No.
Wait, you're doing this quick little, That's not even Southeast Asia. That's
yeah.
Asia,
no, I did Asia. Southeast Asia in April.
Of course.
This is a
Maharaji kinda, butterfly.
I just set up these
out.
Couple of gigs so I could have an excuse to go back to Mongolia in summer and check it out. You know, so September 4th through the 9th, I'm at Zany's in Chicago. 12th through the 16th, I'm in Rosemont at Zany's. September 27th through September 30th, I'm at the Punchline in Atlanta.
I love that place.
October 4th, I'm in Porto, Portugal, doing a comedy festival.
As you do.
October 6th, Lisbon. October 12th and 13th, Paris. The 16th through the 20th is Oslo. The 25th through the 29th.
Those are funny fucking people.
I love Oslo.
Yeah.
It's great there. They're, I really
they're,
like
Norway. They're fun fucking people.
I think it's my favorite place in Scandinavia. 25th through the 29th, Galway, Ireland, doing that comedy festival.
And that's your, if you could live anywhere in the world, you told me.
I would live in Galway.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite places in the world. The 31st is Dublin. November 1st is Belfast. November 3rd, Berlin.
November, this is why you're such a fucking interesting guy. You're one of the most interesting people I've ever met, because how do you not... You know, well, I guess there are moth breathing morons that could travel this way and
moth breathing,
mouth breathing. Sorry, would fucking and their worldview wouldn't fucking change, but yours does. Thankfully, I'm interrupting here. Continue. What else?
Yeah, well, you know, I was trying to make that show where I would be the Anthony Bourdain of comedy, but whatever. Maybe November 8th to the 11th, I'm at the Improv in Addison. The November 12th through 18th. Las Vegas, November 23rd through 27th, Tokyo, Japan.
November 29th. Dude, who the fuck puts your road
December
dates 2nd, together, man?
I'm at the Improv in Pittsburgh. I'm actually really excited about it. My wife, Ashna, like... I've never been to Pittsburgh. So she used to travel with me everywhere, and now she's selective where she wants to go. She wants to go to Pittsburgh because we've never seen it.
Oh, I can tell you some. You got to get, was it Primanti's? You got to get one of their sandwiches.
Yeah.
Their Italian section with all the gabagool and all that shit. Joe Bartnick and Verzi brought me through. They went and got it. Dude, Pittsburgh is one of the great cities this country has.
It's one of the
great comeback
places
cities
in America I've never performed.
One of the, go to a Pirates game. That view with the bridges, it's unbelievable. It's one of my favorite cities. And when you come from the airport, it's the greatest skyline you're going to see, because it's not like you see it. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger. You can't see it at all. And then you drive through like this fucking hill, this tunnel, and then you come out and just boom, it's this panoramic. There's like all of these bridges. There's the ballparks and everything to the left. Heinz Field. What do the Pirates play? I was going to say Pac Bell. That's where the Giants used to play. I forget what the fuck they call it. They change them every year. And then the skyscrapers and they just, there's so much to do there. The food is unbelievable, and the
you should be like Willie Stargell. You should give out little stars for comedians that
that what?
Remember he used to do that?
What, do what?
Willie Stargell, 1979.
Uh-huh.
They called him Pops.
Yeah.
And they had those flat hats back then.
Yep, the old fashioned.
And he used
ones.
To give out little stars to his teammates that he thought whenever they did something great.
Oh, all right.
So on the back of their hats, they had all these stars. Do you remember that?
Yeah, vaguely. Kent DeColvi.
I thought that was like a really cool thing about the Pirates.
I saw him one of his last public experiences.
Kent DeColvi, the sidearmed thrower?
No, appearances. I saw Willie Stargell when he was old. He was sick. You could tell he was dying. And I was at Three Rivers Stadium, and I was watching the Cubs versus the Pirates. And Sammy Sosa was still out in right field. He still looked Cuban. You know, before, have you seen him now?
No,
he's whiter than.
Oh
your
yeah,
shirt.
Yeah, no, yeah. There was some big story about him.
Yeah,
I read recently. Yeah, and he's living in Dubai, and he's he looks like John Fox.
Yep.
Now, that's what Sammy Sosa looks like. Okay, so Pittsburgh, November 29th to December 2nd. I don't think the Pirates will be playing then.
Oh, okay, we'll go to Heinz Field then,
and then. December 10th through the 17th, I'm in Israel. I'm doing this Israel tour. And then...
Where haven't
December
you been?
December 20th through the 22nd, I'm at the Improv in Orlando.
Madagascar? What do we got?
I've never been.
Antarctica? What do we...
I've never... The only continents I have not performed on is Africa and Antarctica.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dude, there's got to be some sort of expedition.
So the
we're putting that out there
comedy,
right now.
The comedy igloo, as soon as that opens.
When the, yeah, the 40th anniversary of The Thing, when they all go down there, you got to get that thing
together. I think I'm going to dial back the international travel next year.
Well, I'm overdue to go to Australia, and I just sort of like, as I get the new hour, I just have it in my head what hour I did the last time I was there, and I always go and have a great time. It's a lot weirder now that I have a kid, so we set up this Easter.
I love Australia. Sydney's one of my favorite cities in the world. All of those cities are great. Brisbane, Melbourne, Perth.
Yeah, I came to Perth on Australia Day. Fucking lunatics. Who knew the El Camino was still popular? So yeah. Popular. They love those fucking things.
Yeah, that, what's the...
I forget what they call it.
I remember going to Australia for the first time. I'm like, what kind of car is that? There's this automobile brand called Holden, and they still make those
El Camino looking
cars. They're great.
Yeah, and people were fucking shit-faced driving all around. I've told you this shit. I went to Bon Scott's grave and somebody...
I went to Bon Scott's grave.
Somebody had a Miller Genuine Draft bottle on there, and I wanted to remove it, but I was like, oh, out of respect for the person that put it there. Eh, Bond probably would have drank it. He wouldn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
But all right, let's wrap this up here. So I just got to say, you're one of my favorite people, one of my favorite comedians, and this has been one of the best podcasts I've done as far as just like fascinating fucking story. I mean, everything. We had life, death, what do you say? Heroic behavior? Heroism? Is that a word?
Heroism.
Heroism, yeah. I've been to a lot of countries, too, and it just doesn't seem to
thanks for having me on, man. You're one of my favorite people to hang out with. Every time you and I get together and we just, like, hang out as buddies, I always get material out of it, you know? I was telling you that story about...
it's probably because I pronounce so many words incorrectly. I was just going to say, I can't imagine how many fucking countries I've been to and I still sound like I've never left my block.
I mean, it's just so great. I was telling you about arguing with my wife because she wants me to clean the toilet, and like I don't want to clean a toilet.
Right.
And you know, a lot of thoughts go through my head during the day. You know, watch a movie, sleep on the couch, call a friend. Cleaning the toilet is not one of them. And we live in an apartment building, so this is what it's like to argue in an apartment building. You make a valid point. Now lower your voice, because I don't want everybody in my building knowing my business. I'm in the laundry room folding clothes. Some guy walks in there. I know you. You're the dude who don't clean the toilet. So, like, I've been doing that I've just started doing that, like, in the last 2 weeks. And that comes from having a conversation with you on my balcony smoking cigars.
Well, because, yeah, you're one of those guys. You're always spitting out material and you don't realize it.
Don't waste that on me. You better do that on stage.
Yeah. I used to get in an argument with me and Neil were still living in an apartment. We used to... she didn't give a fuck, as she calls it. She's passionate. So this is when she would occasionally throw shit at me or punch me in the chest. This is back her younger, wilder days. And I remember we would get into, and I would lose so many arguments because she didn't give a fuck about volume. And I would always be going like, all right, Nia, you made your point. You don't got to have the whole fucking world know about it.
That's it. They get loud.
And she would just
be
like, I don't give a fuck. So then what's worse is you start whispering. So only your shit is coming out. And all the neighbors are like, oh, my God, he's horrible. He's not even arguing. She's so fucking right.
That's where they get you, when they get loud on you.
Well, anyways, so great that you finally came on. Finally got you on. I think it's because we also love smoking cigars and telling stories. So it's like, why would we have a podcast get in the way of that? I'm so glad you came on. You got to promote your dates here. So go see him in Mongolia. If not, you can see him in Pittsburgh, Atlanta.
West Nyack. Addison,
yes.
Orlando.
Yes.
You know, I still play everywhere all over the States, too, right. You know?
And you have a great, like, I majored in, like, radio, communication. You got a great radio voice.
I wish somebody would give me voiceover gigs.
Huh? You know how this town is. You got to take it.
running through the grass on my
tippy toes. There you go. Definitely check him out. He's going to be everywhere. And if he's going to travel that fucking far, you can travel a little bit to go see him. The great Tom Rhodes, everybody. Thank you so much for coming on. Here's a little music for you. And then we have a bonus half hour of greatest hits from a Thursday afternoon podcast from earlier this year or years ago. I don't know. I don't decide. All right. Have a great weekend, you cunts. And I'll talk to you on Monday.